Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. My name is Ann Wardell. I'm a member of the Personal Theology Committee. I like to remind people that we're in our 40th year, which is one of the longest running programs of its type in the UUA. I want to make a quick correction. The actual title of the topic is Holistic Nutrition as a Spiritual Practice. We didn't get that word holistic in there, and that's very important, as Nori will explain. Our speaker today is Nori Hudson, and she's a nutritional consultant and instructor. She holds a bachelor's degree in English and master's in BA, and she's been an instructor at the Bauman College Certified Nutrition Consultant since 2001. She's been teaching there since 2002. She's registered with the board and board certified in holistic nutrition since 2007, and she has a private practice called Radiant Vitality. Radiant Vitality. She has cards in the back. You'll also find some handouts, and she'll be using those throughout her talk. She focuses on the health issues of children and the elderly. And she has taught in her community her son's elementary school, after-school program, graceful aging at Albany Adult School, nutrition consulting at JFK University, and seminars at Elephant. I'm an alum of Elephant, in case you don't know. And she has introduced a nutrition course into the Success Medium Security Dorm at San Quentin, which is amazing. In 2007, she addressed the annual NANP conference with a presentation called How to Sell Life Insurance to a 10-Year-Old, followed by a post-hoc panel of 10-Year-Olds. She's passionate about nutrition, food, and gardening, and she plans to live to 100, so maybe she'll have some ideas for the rest of us. So please welcome Nori Hudson.
Thank you and good morning. It's really lovely to see you all here. As Anne has told you, I am a holistic nutritionist, and my point of view is going to be somewhat different than some of you may have found. And I'm giving you some handouts that I hope will guide you in the journey that we're going to take today, which is about 40 minutes, and then I want to leave plenty of time for questions. So you may find my handout and my talk to answer some of your burning questions, but we'll leave room for you to air those as needed. Some of the ideas I'm going to come up with today are to encourage you to change some of the ways you shop for your food and what you buy and how you eat your food. And I know we all can make some changes there. I did, for sure, and I have, and I continue to make changes. But I want to encourage you to do that as well, based on the things that we are going to come together on here, and that is to help heal the planet. I don't know that we can do it the way we're eating our food now, the way we're growing it. But there are sustainable methods out there that I want to share, and you can encourage those practices by voting with your dollar. We all know that, you know, the economies of using your dollar to encourage that methodology. The way we choose to feed ourselves has such a powerful impact. And so I think the combining holistic nutrition with our spiritual practice, we're going to find the intersection of them is dirt, earth, soil. I even brought some dirt. This is a visual. This is gold. I have a worm bin, and so I have worms that are making this gold. And if you don't have a worm bin, you can recycle your waste and get worms. But we skin the earth of this beautiful gold resource by conventional agriculture. And if you are able to buy from farmers markets or grow your own food and use some of the practices I will mention, I think we can perhaps restore the earth in some fashion and sequester carbon. Right now we know that carbon is one of the biggest threats to the way we live. And the problem is, it's not that we have too much carbon, it's in the wrong place. It's in the atmosphere, and we can get it to go back into the earth where it actually does some good. So I want to just plant that seed for you. All right. The word nutrition comes from Latin nutrire, And that word means a lot of things, but the words I like is that it feeds or nurses and supports and preserves us or whatever we're nourishing or providing nutrition to. The word holistic nutrition has a funny definition. Somebody came to me as a holistic nutritionist. They usually have a whole list of problems. And so you do have to look at more than just the thing before you to find a solution. But the professional organization to which I belong is called the National Association of Nutrition Professionals, and their definition is that holistic nutrition, the philosophy of it, is one's health is an expression of a complex interplay of the physical and chemical or biochemical, the mental and emotional, as well as the spiritual and environmental aspects of our life and our well-being. One of my students is here, so I'm smiling at her. Now, you had a speaker last week who gave an idea of what spiritual practice is, but I'm going to use one that sort of folds into the definition of holistic nutrition, and that is to be spiritual, you have a strong connection to yourself and to the earth and its inhabitants. And those inhabitants include the plants and even the microbiome of the soil, the little beasts that live under there. Actually, they're way more numerous than the beasts on top of the soil. So we have to reverence them as well. And we need to honor that interconnectedness because we're all one, and the interdependency of them because we're all one. So I'd like to propose that intersection I mentioned earlier is dirt, and we honor this precious resource and somehow refurbish it by the voting that we're going to do with the way we buy our food, where we buy our food, and also at the end how we eat. I want to explain holistic nutrition in a way that might make it more real to you, and that is with a story, and it's my story. So in my late 30s, I was becoming aware, probably belatedly, about the concentrated animal feed operations that are growing our animals. Many of you are nodding, and I see you're familiar with those unpleasant ways of putting animals in a very high concentration and feeding them inappropriate food and the waste materials that come from that. If you go on Highway 5 and the smell, I mean, it's really awful. And of course, the animals have horrible life. And many of you may have even become vegetarian or vegan as a result of seeing this abominable way of raising animals. But also at the same time, there was an idea that it would be helpful for our health to eat in a more plant-based way. And I'm all for that. But I also have to tell you that my journey was not as gentle as I had hoped it would be. I decided to become vegetarian. So my journey was for 4 years that I experimented with my body, and we all do that, don't we? I decided not to eat any meat, but I ate eggs and dairy, a lot of grains and legumes, and vegetables and fruits. This all sounds really great. However, I jump into things very dramatically, shall I say. I followed Julia Child when I was eating everything, and Graham Carr, making everything from scratch. So I became Ms. Tofu. I got the Book of Tofu, and I was actually making my own toy tofu, making soy milk, and then straining it and getting the cellulose from the soybean called okara, and making granola out of that, and curdling the milk that was left with either lemon juice or nigiri, and making a curd, and then the whey that's left over, I thought, what am I going to do with that? Some people drink it. I was actually cleaning my wood floors with it. And I thought, you know, this is so inexpensive, we could feed the world, because soybeans only 35 cents a pound. You could feed the world and actually clean the world using that way, because it was so abundant. But over the course of my experimentation and eating way too much tofu, more than a gram a day. By the way, there was a recent study in Japan that showed that people ate more than 30 grams a day. That's a little over an ounce. We're finding they had problems with their thyroid as a result, inflammation of the thyroid. So in my journey, unfortunately, I ate too much of tofu, not knowing any better. I got too much estrogen in my body. And for women and men, too much estrogen can cause some health issues. I had fibroid tumors, endometriosis, inflamed thyroid, and infertility at a young age, well, I thought. So in that case, what happened too is that I had narrowed my bandwidth to eating only a few foods. I lopped these other things off my plate. And so after experimenting and finding I had all these health problems and doing some reading, I no longer could eat soy because it caused irritation, obvious irritation. I could not eat gluten, nor eggs, nor dairy, nor peanuts. Oh my gosh. So eating out's really hard, you can imagine. Breakfast is a real pain. So I found I wasn't alone. Jessica Prentice, who's a local hero of mine, who wrote The Full Moon Feast, I'll read from this at the very end, found in her 10-year journey to vegetarianism that she had dramatic health changes, not on the good side. And Lear Keith, who did her journey of 20 years, she wrote The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice and Sustainability, that she had an irreversible autoimmune condition that is no longer able to be corrected by going back to eating other foods. And I felt, oh my gosh, this is really scary. And also as a nutrition consultant, I found not only in my practice and my teaching and my students, I've been teaching since 18 years, since February 2002, that they too had trajectories that often suggested that that was not the right diet for them. So I think a takeaway at this moment I'd like to share is that I was not listening to my body. They were not listening to their bodies and dug themselves deep into a place that was hard to get out, because we have an emotional connection to the way we eat. We all do. It starts very early. But we have to have the courage to think, is this working for me? And so I did. And I had to give up this idea that I'm not going to eat animals. What else am I going to eat? I can't eat those things I was eating. So I went back to eating animals, but I made a distinctive choice in choosing to source my food from sustainable resources. I found farmers who allowed animals to have a real life and eat their species-appropriate food, which is not soy and grain and wheat, it's grass. And the animals are having a life, which allowed me, even though I'm not killing the animal, to feel better that I'm eating animals. So I kind of made peace in that way. It's not a perfect solution, by the way, but it is the one that I found that could help. Now, after resuming eating an omnivore diet minus all those allergens, I went back to school just shy of my 49th birthday a long time ago, and I found out that there was a school in Bowman, in Berkeley, called the Institute for Educational Therapy, and it's now called Bauman College. So I went to school there, and it opened my eyes to the idea of holistic nutrition, including an idea that I want to share with you called Soul Foods. I love that acronym because it stands for seasonal, organic, unprocessed, and local. And you might not know the specific definition I'm going to use, so I'm going to explain it a little bit. So seasonal means eating things that are growing in your neighborhood. For example, right now, if you go to the farmer's market, and I hope you will, because I'm giving you a list on your handout of those that are available. Kensington is open between 10 and 2. You might make it after church. The artichokes are coming into season, and asparagus are coming into season, mandarin oranges. And these are going to be very fresh, and they're going to be very nutritious in that regard, because if you go to the grocery store, you might not find the freshest food. The things that we would find in Kansas would be very different. We would be eating out of the root cellar. Anyone from Kansas or the Midwest? Yeah, so right now you might be eating rutabaga, celeriac, carrots, parsnips, sweet potatoes, onions, garlic, maybe some winter squash, grains, and cabbage. And cabbage, lots of cabbage. Yeah. So it's a little tricky, isn't it? Sometimes we are so blessed because we have the biggest diversity of any state. We do. And we ship about 50% of the vegetables and fruits and nuts, dairy, and livestock. 50% that the rest of the country uses. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? I like the fact that food comes onto the culinary stage at specific times of the year. For example, when I was living in Berlin and the season of Spargel or asparagus came on, I was just like, oh, so happy to find them in the market, and they have white asparagus. Or say the Pflaumen, the plums for the Pflaumenkuchen, and that had its specific season too, and you celebrate the last opportunity to eat Pflaumenkuchen because it's just so special. And so when we go to the grocery store, we don't lose sight of that, although it's so convenient and the prices are much lower generally, but we lose sight of that seasonality. So anyway, I want to open your eyes to maybe giving your money directly to the farmer, because the grocery store is the middleman and they take some. Farmers are not making a lot of money, and a lot of them are doing it for their love, you know. Another part of the seasonal is that it's dripping with diesel if we don't eat seasonally. Going to the farm, to the grocery store, Michael Pollan uses that term, dripping with diesel, because the average shipping distance for food in this country is 1,500 miles. And unbelievably, I heard a story just the other day. A woman said the food that's coming to feed their children in their school are coming from Minnesota. There's no offense to Minnesota. It's just that at this time of the year, what are we thinking? We have the ability to grow that here. It did not have to be dripping with that much diesel, right? All right. The next part of the word soul is organic. And organic, you probably all know, means we don't use sides, means to kill fungicides, herbicides, and pesticides, because the plants do way better if they're enriched by the soil and become strong accordingly. But we don't prop them up with these synthetics. There's no sewer sludge or biodiesel or any of those things that conventional farming is allowing themselves to use. There's no hormones and antibiotics going into animals if it's an organic model. But the other thing that's really deeper than that is that organic farming promotes more ecological and biological diversity and more support for the soil. The soil does way better when it's not sprayed with all of these chemicals. In fact, the farmers think that they're farming the microbiome. They're not. It's not about the stuff above the ground. It's about what's going in the soil. That's what we need to care about. Certainly, organic food is tastier if you've ever done that experiment. Here's an organic carrot, here's a non-organic carrot. Just see how they taste. And we also might find that there's more nutrient density, because the only way we can get minerals in our body is by what we eat. If you don't add minerals to the soil, those plants will not have minerals, nor will the animals who eat those plants have any minerals. So we have to eat soy from soils that have been enriched appropriately. Sometimes it's expensive to buy organic. So if you have a budget that limits that, and most of us want to spend less on food, the average amount we spend is about 11% of our income. In France, it's about 30%. They have a different value for food, I think. The Environmental Working Group has a list, the Dirty Dozen, and they also have the Clean 15 now. This is the Clean 12. It's an older bag. But I'll pass this around, and you can see what you might want to buy organic because it's dirty, and what you can get by with not being organic because it's already clean. I do use it. Okay. So the next part of soul is unprocessed, and that would mean instead of eating orange juice, drinking orange juice, they have oranges. Instead of eating egg beaters, you would have eggs. There's no reason not to eat a whole egg, and that's a whole other conversation, that there's no danger eating eggs that come from a good source. It won't hurt your heart. It will not hurt your cholesterol, and cholesterol is not the enemy, but that's another story. We also might consider eating corn instead of popcorn, right? I know this is really good stuff, right? But we're not eating the whole food, and we're getting less nutrition from it. The amount of corn in here is about a half a cup, but it's puffed up with air by the industry and make you pay $2.99 for this. Can you imagine? It's ridiculous. Anyway, eating whole foods, there's more nutrition. You might less likely binge on it. I mean, if I had that bag, I'd probably eat the whole bag, right? It's my serving, right? There's some advantages besides that. There's more fiber. It's just way more nutritious to eat the whole food version. There are some processes that we need to take account of. Cooking. Many of you have read Michael Pollan's book, Cooked. And cooking opened the door to us getting nutrition that we would not otherwise get. I'll take a simple example. The carrot comes back here. Eating a raw carrot, you get maybe 3% of the beta carotene or the orange pigment from it. But if you cook it and maybe add some oil, like olive oil or butter, you'll get way more of the beta carotene from that carrot than you did from the raw. Another process is fermentation, that cabbage that you can get in the winter. In the Midwest, if you have fermented it, made sauerkraut of it, you'll get way more vitamin C than you would just eating the cabbage. So some of these processes are rather powerful. Another process would be soaking nuts and seeds. If you're vegan or vegetarian, you're eating a lot of plant seeds. These are legumes, grains, nuts, and seeds. They typically want to be a plant. And we're eating them before they sprout. We're eating them before they realize their full life potential. I don't mean to make you sad. I don't. But I want you to note that you're not going to get the best nutrition from those plants because they have anti-nutrients in them to prevent you from digesting and getting the most from them unless you soak them or you sprout them or you leaven them. These are processes that our traditional ancestors would have done to make them more bioavailable for the minerals that we need that they communicate to our bodies. I can tell you more about that after when we have questions and answers, okay? So nutrient density is rather important, and if we sometimes eat a lot of snack foods and processed foods, we might be able to do that for a while, but ultimately our bodies might think we're in a famine, and it won't serve us for long-term health. The last part of seasonal organic and processed is local, and it's similar to seasonality, but local may mean more than that, and that we eat from our food shed. And our food shed is 50 to 100 miles from here. So many of the farmers who come, I ask them, how far have you come? They'll say, I've come from 80 miles away. So that's within my food shed. Jessica Prentice, who wrote the book I mentioned earlier, Full Moon Feast, and two of her friends developed something called the Local Food Wheel. I'll pass this around. There's 5 of these for the United States. So you can ask, buy one online and give it to your friends on the East Coast so they'll know what's in season. How it works is on the part that moves, this food is available all year around here. But if you move it to the month that we're in, like February, this revealed part here is what's available now growing here in our food shed. So you can see that we have celery and artichokes, beets, some escarole, crab, parsnips, and celery root. So, anyway, it's a really cool tool. Allows you to make some choices, or you can just go to the farmer's market and see what's growing and be surprised. You know? That could be really cool. Some other things that you might want to do, the reasons to go local, go back to that, is that the food is generally only 24 hours out of the soil, really fresh. You might get more variety that way. You lower the fuel cost. They're not going to be dripping with diesel. And you'll probably find that the soil and environment will be greatly more enhanced by having your farmers not have to trade so far to bring you food. Other ways you can support your local economy is to go to farmers markets, as I mentioned earlier. If you are out of town and want to go, like I did, to Alabama in November, you can go to localharvest.org and you can find a farmer near where you're going to be, or a farmer's market, and patronize that so you give your dollar to the farmer. localharvest.org. Another thing to do is support community-supported agriculture. Does anyone get a box regularly from the farmer? Yay. You know what this is about. You're giving the farmer capital up front. They can fix the tractors. They can get the soil amendments. They can buy the seeds. They can pay their workers, all of which can be extraordinarily helpful to free them up to grow plants for you, and you can choose what size box you want. Many kids only eat produce from their farm, but at least they're eating produce, because I know if you've had children, you know how hard that can be. You can have the advantage of getting the freshest food, knowing that you're making an incredible contribution to a local economy. You get to visit your farm once or twice a year, pick your own pumpkin, maybe some leftover strawberries from the season. If you want, you can also get a community garden plot, or you can actually grow your own food in your yard. Front yards are not off limits in most communities for growing edibles. So there's not a real reason that we can't eat seasonally organic, unprocessed, and local. It's an old model. Many of you may recall this is how your parents ate or your grandparents ate. It's not unusual, is it? Really? So how do we get off track? It's a big story. This is one that kind of breaks my heart, I'm afraid. But I did the research over the course of several weeks, and so I was able to process that journey a little bit. Whenever we have moved into an area to settle as human beings, we have wreaked havoc. There are some exceptions. Some indigenous people really know what to do with the land. But we clear cut. We fumigate soils. We get rid of all the indigenous species, including the plants and the animals. And the opportunistic annual crops move in. They're only band-aids for that bare soil. Rice, barley, wheat, corn. These are native, these are annuals that move in. Native wild versions come in. We ravage the soil by having these plants grown over and over without the interlude of having perennial crops come in or animals come in to enrich the soil. And this has gone on and on and on for several years. Right now, we have currently 90% of the water taken from the environment is for irrigation, because when you grow annuals, you need water. So we're wasting and squandering a lot of water. The water table rises, the soil becomes salinated. It turns out that worldwide, 25 million acres of arable land are lost each year to salinization. It's too salty for us to grow our food in. We move on. So I want you to think about the Fertile Crescent. You've heard of the Fertile Crescent. It's from the Nile River to Iraq. If you take a look at some of the pictures online, what it looks like now, it's a desert. It's very rocky, scrubby vegetation growing there, not really fertile anymore. If you look at the Indus Valley in Pakistan, a similarly previously beautiful area of growth and fertile crops, it's a desert. If you look at North Africa, it's a desert. You look at Australia, they've squandered 70% of their soil. It's a desert. And you look at our prairie, 99.8% has disappeared, and only 1% of the bison that used to roam and improve the soil are left. So we've really done a number on the soil. Instead of growing these prairie grasses, Chris had this wonderful picture, which I'll pass around because it's probably hard to see in the reflection. These plants have very long roots, and the roots can form the soil. What they can do is this bi-directional feeding. They take carbon from the air, and then they take it, sequester it into the soil, and these long tap roots bring water and minerals up into the plant, and the plant then delivers that mineral to the topsoil or to the animals eating that, and then the animal poo will have mineral-rich residue, and that will be a life and death cycle. If you want to pass it around, it's a rather good. What we're doing now is we're growing hybridized, genetically engineered crops in huge swathes of land in the Midwest. Unfortunately, most of it's corn and soy. Animals that used to live there try to make their habitat there. They're nesting there, mice, rabbits, birds, raccoons, and the threshers kill them. The chemicals used to fertilize or fumigate the soil are very hazardous to the soil, the pests, the microbiome, farm workers, and us. That's the model, unfortunately. That is a conventional farming model. From a wildlife protector named Deanna Wolf, she says, the wildlife includes the millions of tons of soil life that live in a typical 100-acre swathe of farmland. So we're killing this, you know, living creature living under the earth that nourishes what grows in it. She says, just cleaning the land to grow soybean and corn has killed about everything on half the world. That hurts. I was eating a lot of that soy. Global Citizen said that of the remaining birds we have, 70% are farmed chickens. So you might say, all right, well, gee, what are we growing all these crops for? There are two parts to that. One, we grow them to feed animals. We grow them also because we can, because we have fertilizers that's allowed us to amplify the yield per acre. Unfortunately, it's not a sustainable model. 90% of the soy is fed to livestock worldwide, and their industrial-scale soybean industries, together with ranchers and loggers that are destroying the Amazon as we speak. These crops require huge amounts of the sides as well as lime, and it's an environmental and ecological disaster. Over 80% of the soybeans in the U.S. are genetically engineered, and the two-thirds worldwide. What does that mean? Do you all know what genetically engineered means? You've heard that, yeah. So it's so they can withstand an herbicide called Roundup, in which an ingredient glyphosate is rather dangerous to our bodies. I'll talk about that in a moment. 40% of the corn grown is for livestock. 40% now is for ethanol, interestingly. They have very high yields. Corn can grow in every state. It has a lot of end-use variability. You can make a lot of things out of corn. Unfortunately, it squanders the nitrogen in the soil, and it's water hungry. And genetically engineered is 92%. We subsidize both of those crops. We subsidize farmers in order to buy, to pay them for their crops. They buffer crop failure, price variability, and surpluses. But it's important to note that this food is extremely unhealthy for the animals to which it's being fed. That includes us. These animals are not designed to eat grain. They're designed to eat grass. Andrea Berginer said there's no debate. Growing grain for cattle or any other animals who eat grass, not grain, is one of the worst ideas humans have had. But the incentives were to grow them fast, to grow them in economical ways so we could have cheap pork, poultry, and beef. And we're voting with our dollar by supporting that, I think. According to Lierre Keith, she said grains turn the normal neutral stomach acid of a cow into an acidic mass, making them bloated and sick, and it halts the rumination and causes a foam slime to trap gases that lead to their suffocation. They just keel over in the feedlot. If they last, they can get susceptibility to bacterial and parasitic infections or liver abscess. And chickens eating the high amount of grain, they do need some because they won't lay eggs without them. I've had chickens. The chickens will get a fatty liver just by eating the fewer volume that they're fed in the CAFO operations. I mentioned that grain feeding is not healthy for us either. These are all from high omega-6 fatty acid grains. Omega-6s can become pro-inflammatory. That would mean that you might have health problems because you may have more omega-6s than omega-3s in your body. Omega-3s are anti-inflammatory, and they come from grain-fed or grass-fed animals and fish, flaxseed, and walnuts. Some of the things that also come through in CAFO animals is that we get glyphosate into our bodies, and that's been linked to some of the health issues that we're struggling with, obesity, autism, autoimmune disease, as well as infertility and depression. This is Stephanie Seneff's work. She's an MIT professor. Finally, if you are sensitive to wheat or soy or corn, and you eat the animals that eat that, you might also not feel well eating those foods because they're coming through the animal in their products or their meat. In the early 20th century, there's a man named Fritz Haber. Do you know the name? He actually developed fertilizer. He was able to fix nitrogen from the soil, combine it with gas and coal, the hydrogen from those sources, and make ammonium nitrate, which has been used for explosives as well as fertilizer. Interesting. This is in 1918. And after that, we were able to save billions of lives. He's been credited. He got the Nobel Prize in 1918, praised for saving billions of people from starvation simply because we were able to increase the yield per crop per acre of crops and feed people. But this form of synthetic nitrogen has had a devastating effect on the planet. not only is it now used for using fossil fuel, we don't have a lot of fossil fuel yet, but it takes 4 calories of fossil fuel to grow 1 calorie of food. Is that inefficient or what? This is, definitely. The nitrogenous fertilizers also tend to run off the soil into the waterways together with the CAFO manure lagoons, which have high nitrogen as well, and they form algae blooms and dead zones that can paralyze anything that's in that water area. So outside of the mouth of the Mississippi, there is a dead zone that's as large as New Jersey because of agricultural runoff and the nitrogen that's being eaten. It forms the algae, the bacteria eat the algae, the bacteria use up all the oxygen, and then there's nothing that can breathe in that zone. This did push the yields of the crops. Unfortunately, though, it does ravage the soil and take away a huge amount of water that we definitely need. If you're interested in a really nice animated film, nice in the sense that it's quick and easy to understand, it's called The Matrix, not The Matrix, The Matrix. And it's about how big agriculture has basically scooped up all these small farms and aggregated animals in these feedlots and also done monocropping of all of the grains that feed into the CAFO. We can stop this. The casualty of this agribusiness is not only small farms here in the United States, but also in other countries who suffer from us dumping our surplus into their economy. Think of Mexico, who has stopped growing their own corn because it's cheaper to get it from us. Not a good model. The other thing is CAFO accounts for 72% of poultry production. So you have to ask. You may pay more. If you can get a $5 roasted chicken from Costco, you know that's a CAFO chicken. $5 for a roasted chicken at Costco, you know that's a CAFO chicken. That is a concentrated animal feed operations. You know that is what's happened. Because there's no way for them to grow that. A chicken at Full Belly Farm at the farmer's market on Saturday or from Victoria Farmstead on Sunday, $26. Now, I know that's a big price gap for a lot of people. You don't have to eat as much. If you're going to eat chicken, you can eat less. You don't have to eat as much and eat a lot more vegetables with it. But the problem is that not only are these animals, well, that's poultry. There's 43% of egg production. So inexpensive eggs are also on the market, and we buy them because we don't want to spend a lot of money on food. 55% of pork production is CAFO. 99% of beef and turkey, and 50% of fish are now farmed, that are sold in the market. The other side effects of eating CAFO is that there are antibiotics and hormones put into beef specifically, not only the dairy, but the beef cow. And those antibiotics are now creating superbugs that we're no longer able to address. Many companies have been formed and then gone bankrupt trying to form new antibiotics to counter these superbugs that are being created because they're passing through into us and making us resistant to those antibiotics. Not a good model. And hormones, there's 6 growth hormones put into animals to get them to the market, and they pass through and are available in all of the parts of the animal, the organ meat, the muscle meat, and so on. CAFOs use a huge amount of water, and an argument that vegetarians often make is that to grow 1 pound of beef, it takes 2,500 gallons of water. That's in a CAFO situation. But if you have a grass-fed animal, it uses 122 to 200 gallons for 1 pound. Comparison-wise, that's less than a pound of tofu or rice or corn, and it's 1/4 the amount needed to grow 1 pound of almonds. There's 2,000 gallons of water needed to grow a pound of almonds. That's stunning, isn't it? You can go to foodprint.org. That's on your handout. Foodprint.org is a website, and it gives really fascinating information. The good news is I got an email from Dianne Feinstein last week. It wasn't personal. It was, you know, that's not going to happen. But it was response to me signing a petition, and she announced that the Senate has introduced a bill that is going to be the Farm System Reform Act, and by 2040, their goal is to get rid of all the CAFOs. And so, well, we don't know how the Senate will go with that. We have a current administration that may not support that. But let's see, let's be optimistic. That's a good step in the right direction, wouldn't you not say? Yeah. So what can be done for us to grow, growing our food sustainably? We have the ability to support this farmland grazing. Did you know that much of the Earth's land is unsuitable for growing crops? It's too cold, it's too hot, it's too wet, it's too dry, or even too steep. But much of it can be grazed by animals. When I went back to eating meat, I found a grower in San Juan Bautista who is managing parklands with his herd of cattle. And the land is sustainably manipulated through careful grazing. And every spring, the flowers there are amazing because they're getting fertilizer from these cows that are on that land, eating their species-appropriate food, eating the food that they're meant to grow to eat. These perennial grasses also are one of the best things to nourish the soil and sequester carbon. When I went to Iceland for a small week-long trip, not about 4 years ago, I noticed that their sheep are eating lichen on the stones. Iceland is very rocky, and they cut down all the trees. You know how the Vikings did their number. So anyway, I just want to say that there are ways for us to use the land more effectively. According to Judith Schwartz, who wrote Cows Save the Planet, it's a book on your list, she says herbivores aerate and nourish and graze the land in ways that regenerate all the basic building blocks. It increases productivity. With the management of time and frequency and intensity of grazing, plus a less stressful way of handling the animals, it serves to stop desertification, causing deserts. She says that we can reverse desertification, sequester carbon, improve biodiversity, and raise the nutrient density of our food just by having animals on the land. The soil from which we get 95% of our food determines the nutritional value that we get from the food grown in it. Sequestering carbon is one of the things that is uppermost in our minds today. We have to stop the emissions, or we have to find a way of reducing carbon. And if we all supported this carbon farming, carbon farmers, we might be able to sequester one-third of annual carbon emissions, according to estimates that have been given recently. That's a lot. And we may not meet that horrible tipping point, but that makes us a little nervous every day we think about it. So the focus isn't on the soil, isn't on the animals, but on the soil and the grass. One of the people whose books I've mentioned, Folks This Ain't Normal by Joel Salatin, he says he's a grass farmer. Because if I don't have grass, I can't have animals. So if we focus on the right thing, then we're not ravaging the soil and making it a desert. We have to stop the grain cartels as well. Somehow the subsidies are not working to grow more than we need and export it and dump it on other markets is not great. Eating local animals is important as well. Indigenous and traditional people would view the animal as a gift. And they are. It's a life. And it's an obvious life. The hunt and the slaughter are ritualized and all the parts of the animals are used. And I tried to make an effort to do that because the animal died for me so that I could live. The bones for the broth, the organ meat for nutrient density that's far beyond what's in the muscle. Say a thank you for the animal that gave its life. But we're so disconnected with the processes that create and provide our food, we don't have to kill our own animals. If we did, I think it would change the way we eat, definitely. We're removed from that life and death cycle, and we're free of the karma of killing our own food sometimes because of that. Some of the potential consequences, though, of not eating meat, I found occurred with me. I ended up having nutrient deficiencies, and some of my clients and students have as well. Animal protein is concentrated. It's very concentrated because all the plants have been run through the animal. But if you are eating plants, I remind you to soak your nuts and seeds so that you amplify their nutritional content and cover some of the nutrient deficiencies that may occur because you're not getting them from animals. There's a list on your handout that tells you some of the common nutrient deficiencies. Not enough protein, Even if we're not growing girls and boys, we do need protein on a regular basis, at least 20 grams per meal. There's a chart for you to estimate how much that is. The other thing is you may find you're low in vitamin B12. It's only available, bioavailable in animals. So getting checked. The symptoms and signs of B12 deficiency, some of which look like being an old person. We do not want to be old people when we get old. Okay? Okay. The other thing that I want to give you an alert on, and then I want to round up with a couple of other points, and that is if you don't feel that you digest your food, it just sits in your stomach like a hockey puck, you know, it doesn't move. And if maybe you haven't eaten meat and you then resume eating meat and that happens also, try to check your stomach acid. There's a small test that uses baking soda in water. You just dissolve it in 6 ounces of water, 1/4 teaspoon, drink it on an empty stomach. And then, if you should burp within 5 minutes, you have to time it, okay? You have to burp because you're taking an alkaline substance with the lemon juice in the water and putting an acid with the alkaline. You make a little mini explosion. Don't be scared. You won't feel it. And it causes some gas to be produced, and it comes up, and then you have a burp. But you want to burp within 5 minutes. It will tell you if you have enough stomach acid. And if you don't, then you might want to take some digestive bitters or digestive enzymes. And I'm passing this around. These are enzymes that are somewhat bitter. The way to taste this, because we're all sharing, is you just take a little drop. It's got turmeric in it, so it'll cause you to have a little yellow spot. And put some on your hand and just taste it like that. When you do use it, you put it in some water and drink it before your meal. You want to try? Okay.
So just a little drop.
Or two, just so you get an idea of the taste, because it'll stimulate your stomach acid and help you better digest your food. I find that in my practice, people over 50 tend to not make enough stomach acid. If you have a low thyroid, you may not make enough stomach acid either. Okay, I wanted to then move on, because I know that was a heavy-duty topic right there, to mindful eating. And I just read a book called Mindless Eating by Brian Wansick. It's very funny. He has a lab where he can experiment as to why we eat. And he says in a recent poll in his book, there's 1,600 people, he said, unfortunately, 91% of people typically watch TV while they're eating. Yeah. That's interesting. And he said 62% sometimes are often too busy to sit down and eat. So we have work to do here. I do know people who do not take pleasure from eating, but it is one of the most pleasurable things we can do for our bodies, to nourish it and take in our food with thought, to think about how we're getting our food and give thanks to those who grew it for us, because most of us are not growing our food. And to send good wishes to it as it gets broken down, hopefully, with good digestion, good stomach acid, and good digestive function and absorption. But if we're chowing down and hoovering our food, and I've seen people do that, because childhood habits are set early, right, in life. You're the last one at the table, you have to do the dishes, or you don't get seconds unless you eat fast. But if we take at least 20 minutes to eat, there's a big change in the way our digestion works. We get satiety messages from hormones that say, oh, food's coming. And hormones also suggest to the gallbladder and the pancreas, okay, we need your input to help us digest this food. Wansick found the faster we eat, the more we eat. Yeah. He also found the more variety, the more we eat. Now, I want to give you an example, the Chinese food buffet. You want to try everything, right? So you eat more. The more there is, the more we eat. So if I was given the illusion this is my bag, this is my serving, it's a lot of popcorn, I'd probably eat a lot more of this. But it's actually, the nutrition facts tell me this is 4 servings. 4 measly servings. Yes. And it looks like I have a lot to eat, so I'll probably eat more than my serving if I were to eat this. I also found from his research, he said, the more we like the food, the faster we eat. And also eating with others, we may eat 35% more. That's not to discourage you from eating with others, because you can slow down if you sit next to somebody who eats more slowly. Most of us actually decide what to eat before we even come to the table. We put it on our plate saying, well, that's about right, right? And then we sit down. And we don't stop eating simply because our stomach gets full, like, you know, we're distended here. But it's more like that we've chewed a number of times, we've thought about the food, we've swallowed a number of times, and we've also been sitting at the table a certain length of time. The food industry has added a lot of things to the food that makes us want to eat more than we need to. They have created 3,800 calories for every man, woman, and child in this country to consume. That's way more than we need, right? 3,800 calories per day. And they want you to switch to their brand and overeat theirs and buy some more. So they withhold satiety factors, the things that make you feel satisfied, so that you'll want to eat to the bottom of the bowl and still want more and buy another product. It sounds evil, doesn't it? They add chemicals. There's a wonderful book. They add chemicals to these products that will make you want to eat more and more and more. And the guy Moss, who wrote Sugar, Salt, Fat, it's on the list of books that I've given you on the handout, and you might find that book an interesting read. Really fascinating. Fascinating. Anyway, their goal is health. It's not profit. It's not health. It's profit. And they also want you to continue to buy their products. So I have some ideas for eating mindfully. One is to plate your food. Not just eat out of whatever came from the fridge or the pot off the stove, but sit down to eat. Other is to consider removing distractions so that you're actually thinking about the food. So no TV, no checking your mail, no preparing for your talk, things like that. And then set the table. I found this has helped a lot of people to set the table with candles, a placemat or a tablecloth, have a nice view. Just think about your food. It's hard because we're not used to it, and it may take a while. Don't eat outside of the dining area, like in your car, your bedroom, bathroom. I mean, people eat in weird places. And put down your eating utensils and take a breath in between meals. Just some people hold their breath the entire time they're eating just because that's how they got used to it. Chew more times than are necessary and eat with a slower eater, maybe. And try to finish on at the same time. That sometimes works. And all the way while listening to your body. Okay, just some ideas. So the last thing I want to share with you is from Jessica Prentice's Full Moon Feast. I'm going a little longer than I expected. The Full Moon Feast has several moons, and we're in the Hunger Moon, where we're eating from our cellar, okay? But this I'm reading from the Blood Moon, which is supposedly in mid-autumn. And it's really a tome to honor animals, so I want to come back to that. On the Blood Moon, may we say a heartfelt prayer for all the animals that are being raised in inhumane conditions. May we give great thanks for the farmers and ranchers who treat their animals with respect and honor and who care deeply for their welfare. May we take the time to seek out sources of animal foods that are raised with respect for the environment, for our health, and for the well-being of the animals themselves. May there come a day when factory farms have been replaced with small-scale, integrated, holistic family farms where all living things are recognized as the gifts they surely are. May there be a day when Americans have acquired the adult knowledge that all life is interdependent upon all other life in an endless cycle of giving and receiving, birth and death, growth and decay, rebirth and regeneration. And may we find ourselves humble as we contemplate the miracle of life and the life that transcends death, and that would make our ancestors proud. So thank you very much.
Microphone. Do we have any questions?
You had yours up first. Wait for the
okay. For those of you who have questions, this is a very directional microphone, so talk straight into it, because if you turn it this way, it doesn't work.
Okay.
I
Nora, you said something about that what got you interested in this in the first place, but I didn't hear about what your situation was that initially got you to start playing around with your diet.
Well, initially it was because of the CAFO situation, seeing animals being treated so poorly. So that turned me towards trying an experiment. No, not at all. I thought I was 100% healthy. Yeah. CAFO. It's Concentrated Animal Feed Operations. I'm sorry for not having identified that more thoroughly. Did that answer your question? Okay.
Oh, thank you for your being here today. I've been looking forward to your talk since I saw it on the schedule. But I just have a couple of things about your bag of popcorn. How is that different than just popping your own corn? Or are you against popping corn altogether? And the other thing is about your comment on here about seeds contain anti-nutrients and must be neutralized. I heard you say something about you need to soak seeds and nuts, but I just go to the store and buy seeds and nuts. I don't soak them when I get home.
You might get more from them, but let me start with the popcorn story.
Yeah.
Okay, I think it's fine for you to make your own popcorn if you want to. Buying it in a package is ridiculous. I mean, it's not a rocket science to make your own popcorn, really. Well, you're paying more for it, obviously, and from a nutritional point of view, you can control the ingredients way better if you do it yourself. But I'm going to, as a nutritionist, I want to also warn you about the popcorn.
Okay.
There's undigested particles in the popcorn that make it through the digestive tract despite all your inputs that can shred your intestines and can make your ileocecal valve misbehave. Now, you may not notice that, like, you can't say, oh, my ileocecal valve is misbehaving. But you might feel, oh, something's not right here. Things aren't working properly. And your bowel movements will change, which is a digestive signature that something isn't working. So I've had numerous people figure out, and my colleague, Laura Knopf, who wrote a book on irritable bowel syndrome, talk about popcorn in the most dark ways. This is something you really don't want to be eating a lot of, and people tend to eat a lot of it because it's a diet food. So that's one thing. And the second thing is you're soaking the nuts and seeds. The life of a seed is ideally going to be to make it through the digestive tract intact of a bird or something that ate it and come out the other end with a little fertilizer. So, and then become a plant. So what we do when we soak the nuts and seeds is we get rid of the things that prevent digestion, called anti-nutrients, phytates, lectins, oxalates, trypsin inhibitors. We get those away by soaking nuts and seeds in salt water, or we soak our legumes and grains in acidified water with lemon juice or vinegar before we prepare them. And the time, it depends on the size of those nuts, those seeds. And then after draining them and rinsing them and letting them come almost to a sprout, then we use them. And if you go to Costco, sometimes I do, there is sprouted pumpkin seeds. And try that compared to your pumpkin seeds out of the bin and just see the taste difference. But you will get more nutrition from them when they are sprouted, that's for sure. And so just want to amplify your nutrition, because as we get older, it's more work for us to get what we need to from our food. And check your stomach acid, too, as I mentioned. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Another question? Yeah.
I came because you said that you had been working inside San Quentin, and I was wondering what you were doing there.
Oh, that's a really good story. I'll make it brief because of time. But one thing that was rather exciting for me is that they'd never had a nutrition program before. And they had a lot of other things, like how to be a dad, 12-step programs, and gardening. And this was in the success dorm. These are medium security prisoners who had a chance to get out and reenter the world. But they were trying to give them the tools to do so. And they earned their position in the success dorm by a good behavior and other things. So this nutrition program was not that successful initially, until they found I was serving snacks. And then they filled the room. And what was interesting is they ate everything I brought, including seaweed salad. And, you know, and some of the guys were going, oh, I don't know if I'm going to touch that. And somebody else would say, well, I ate it when I was a kid, and it was good. But by the end of the seminar, we would have it. It was gone. And I would only feed them organic. And the model I gave them was to go to the farmer's market at the end of the day when the farmers don't want to ship all that, take all that salad mix back home because it's not going to last. And they'll give it to you for less. And I got lots of donations from farmers because of my work and was really grateful to be able to bring them and explain to them that you're worth it. You know, I want to give you the best so that they also can make good choices on the outside, how they call it, getting out on the outside by choosing to make good food choices. Yeah. Yes.
Hi. First of all, thank you for your talk. I just found it inspiring, and
thank you.
I'm going to go home. I don't know about soaking nuts.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I do have a snack of peanuts or walnuts, but soaking them makes them soggy.
Okay.
And the if you could just also comment on fish. I try to follow the Monterey Aquarium fish, and I wondered if that's adequate.
Okay, yeah, you're right. They do turn really slimy and awful. And so the trick is after you soak them and then you drain them and you didn't dehydrate them or crisp them up again, but at a very low heat. Should you not want to do that, and any of you not want to go through that process, but want to eat your nuts and get the most out of them, there happens to be a community-supported kitchen that was co-founded by Jessica Prentice and four other people called Three Stone Hearth. Anybody go to Three Stone Hearth? You know about it. It's a really interesting place. And you can get crispy nuts, almonds, and walnuts that they've put it in salt water and gotten them to the point where they're ready to give their most energy. And then they dehydrate them at a low temperature so it protects the oils. So you, in theory, you want to get it at like 120 degrees Fahrenheit, no hotter than that. It takes all day when I use my dehydrator. But otherwise, you can just go there and buy it from them. If you go to Three Stone Hearth, I'll pass this around. By the way, they're closing from March 15th through May 15th because of a roof problem. So, yes, they're located in Berkeley at the old, very old co-op on University Avenue. Yeah. And the other question? Monterey Fish is getting their information from the government. They just announced outlets from it, and I have some hesitations about fully endorsing that because they don't take into account the possibility of predatory fish having high mercury levels. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of studies that have been done on the mercury burden in like halibut and cod and things like that. They have medium amounts of mercury, which we can then ingest and it could hurt us. Tuna I would not buy. So they have, there's a website, it's the FDA, you can find it in your search engine, FDA plus mercury plus fish. It's an old list, it's almost 9 years old, unfortunately, and there's nothing new that succeeded it. And the sample sizes were small, but there's nothing else to guide us. But mercury is ubiquitous in our environment because we've had volcanic action, coal burning, runoff, from mining, all kinds of mercury has come into our waterways, and the fish are in that waterway. So we have to be mindful that that is not the largest source, but it is a source of mercury. So eat lower on that. Sardines and salmon are fairly good, and you know, farmed, of course. You're welcome. Yes.
Do you have any comment on cooking methods? I read somewhere that steaming was better than microwaving, which was better than...
That's a good idea.
Huh?
Yeah.
Good.
That's good.
It?
Keep going.
Whoa. Well,
no, I think
okay.
You're right. Low and slow is considered a really good way to cook.
But it has...
And I'm not a fan of microwaving. I have one in my bedroom to microwave my rice pack to warm the bed, if my cat hasn't already done that. So it's really a nice thing to think about going slowly and cooking as almost a meditation in itself. If you have a crock pot or an instant pot, you basically can shortcut your cooking time and get more from the nutrition. Steaming, I don't find the flavor so exciting as baking or roasting, but sometimes braising makes a tough cut of meat, which is what you're going to get from a grass-fed animal, makes a tough cut of meat taste much, much better and more tender. But you have to go long. You have to... You do a braising method, which is moisture with the meat. So think of bœuf bourguignon or coq au vin, you know, these French methods where you are cooking with a liquid, with broth and wine, and the meat will become tender and easy to chew. Does that answer? Yeah.
I was wondering about the organic food that you can buy in the grocery store. Is that really organic?
I don't know the answer. I'm assuming that they're responsible in their labeling. I'm hoping that's true. If I go to the natural grocery store, I go to the Gilman Street one or the one in San Pablo. I like small companies. I always admire that they're going to try it. They do 100% organic, and they wouldn't label it otherwise. So I do that. But I'm going to go to the farmer's market after this talk and shop at the farmer's market because I want to support them in doing what they're doing and give them my dollar, even if it's a little large and larger than the supermarket. Hi, Rachel. Oh, wait, there was one person back here. Yes.
I don't know if you already spoke to gluten and the connection with Alzheimer's and memory and how hard it is for people because it's so addictive and the connection with blood sugar.
Yeah.
The diabetic blood sugar. And if you can squeeze in a plug about the dangers of 5G before you leave. I recently heard a big broadcast about that, and I'm really scared now.
Well, just a sidebar on that because of the time, and also I could talk for another hour about everything you just said. I think gluten is a protein that many of us are unable to digest well. Just your own experiment might have revealed that to you by taking it out. Gluten is in rye and wheat and barley and spelt and kamut, and it's cross-contaminating oats unless you get gluten-free oats. So if you have celiac disease, which is an autoimmune disease, that's really only 1% of people who have problems with gluten, but there are people who are non-celiac gluten sensitive. So NCGS is the acronym for that, and I'm one of those. And so eating gluten is partly because they've hybridized the grains, but also because we eat so much of it that we've caused our bodies to revolt. And with an autoimmune disease, it's just like the first thing I tell people is go gluten-free because it can cause your immune system to go crazy. And the immune system is also in the brain, and so Alzheimer's disease is considered type 3 diabetes, so it's a blood sugar issue as well as a problem of inflammation in the brain. And there are specialists who are identifying the many ways that the brain is inflamed. A book that was written recently called The End of Alzheimer's by Dale Bredesen, he's an MD, talks about three different inflammatory profiles that occur with Alzheimer's. My father had it, his sisters did, and his mother, their mother did. So it's near and dear to my talk. I mean, I can come back and give you more information, but I do think we all have to listen to our bodies and experiment with things that I'm not feeling my best, and your doctor will say, well, you're just getting old. I don't buy that. Do you? That's not fair, because there are a lot of young, old people, really, and we want to have quality of life. So if you're not having your get up and go, you know, start looking at the things, especially the things to which we feel, oh, I can't possibly give up gluten, because we have an attachment to it. There are gluteomorphins in there that are taking the place of endorphins. These are feel-good hormones. Endorphin means endogenous morphine, you know. We make that. We make it with acupuncture, good sex, capsaicin, chocolate, anyone? We can get our endorphin fix from that, but gluten and casein from dairy can give us substitutes for that, but they don't last as long and can cause us to be attached to those foods for longer than is necessary and eat them more frequently because, yeah. Did that help? Yeah. So, Rachel.
So I was told that there's a difference between
That's right. So between an organic farmer and one who is organically certified or organic certified, is that the case that there is a difference between the two?
Tell me the first term again.
Organic, an organic stand versus just organic. Organic, certified organic. Is there a difference between the two?
I don't know off the top of my head. There is the Organic Consumers Association have a definition that are all available to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it has to do with the percentage of the ingredients that is considered organic. So mm-hmm. they've manipulated the definition so that it'll say organic, and that'll it's like gluten-free. It'll get you to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Like this package says gluten-free, and it's organic, and it'll get you to buy it. But how much of the ingredients is organic? They allow you to have up to like only 80% organic using that term.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's 100% certified organic, then all of the ingredients are. But here, they don't tell you that the cultured milk, the salt enzymes are organic, nor is the salt. Yeah, so it's probably using the generic term of organic, but it doesn't mean everything is. Chris.
You might want a different last question. Is it okay to address constipation with products like Metamucil, or is our diet supposed to be so perfect that we don't have those issues?
Wow. Or Miralax for babies. My goodness. I think that there are reasons that we have slower transit time, which is moving our food through our bodies. If you've not done this test, it's a really fun one to do. At least kids like it. You want to eat something that will mark your stool, like white sesame seeds. Take them, don't chew them, but a couple of tablespoons of white sesame seed, or red beet, or fresh corn, or charcoal, activated charcoal, not the briquette, activated charcoal, and time it. So, okay, I put it in my body now at noon today. When do I first see it next? And then you note that it's like greater than 48 hours, then you might have something called constipation. The medical definition of constipation is that you are having only three bowel movements a week. And that's interesting because if I don't go in just one day, I feel constipated and I feel like it's a message for me. We need to pay attention to it instead of medicalize it. So the number one reason for people to have constipation is they're having allergic reactions to their foods. And the one number one food in that group is dairy. So that's one thing. And there's lots of research that says you do not have to have fiber to have bowel movements. Now, we've been told that a lot, and you don't have to drink a lot of water to have bowel movements. So I can't answer all of those variabilities for every one of you. I'm only going to say you may want to do your own experiment. But test test what you are doing in terms of the transit time, how quickly food moves through, and then intervene with something that might be an idea. So instead of having iceberg lettuce, or romaine lettuce, have cabbage slaw with kale, which has more fiber. Instead of having a salmon that's just sitting there on the plate baked, have it pistachio crusted, which will give you more fiber. Instead of having a regular white potato or white rice, have brown rice or a sweet potato, and just up your fiber slowly so you don't, you know, it doesn't literally backfire on you. Up it slowly so that you can start to feel, what is the sensation in my body? Is it getting used to this new idea of adding more fiber? Is that making a difference? And it may be also examining what are the allergens that might be drawing you to eat more often than you should. I don't know if that's going to answer your questions entirely, but those are some ideas. I wouldn't use it full time, and I wouldn't use it all the time. I think we can, as with anything, become addicted to it and then also reactive to it. So I always hesitate to say don't do anything all the time. If you are, step back from it and look at it at least once a week, once a month, and see if that's working for you.
Okay, thank you, Nori. And she has a sign-up sheet in the back if you want to give your email, and she also has some business cards.
Yes.
So thank you very much.
You're very welcome.